My name is Margaret Ann. I'm from Cambridge, Massachusetts. I've been an Overeaters Anonymous since 1990. The thing that I was, when I was told that might be nice, and I know that you've had some other retreats that are on this theme of unity, every intergroup always needs people to be involved at intergroup. And every intergroup is always helping, you know, hoping to encourage people to do service at the group level. So part of it was about unity. And Seattle, like many, many other areas in Overeaters Anonymous, has different meetings that work the program in different ways. Now, some of you are very, very new. And I know when I came into Overeaters Anonymous, I came in Boston where we had several different kind of factions of meetings. And it was confusing and sometimes very upsetting to me. The theme of these writings really is about a theme of unity. Looking at it through the first step in the first tradition, the second step in the second tradition, and the third step in the third tradition. First step, surrender. First tradition, also kind of a surrender. The first tradition states unity. Where is it? Yes, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon OA unity, which is really a kind of surrender, I believe. I'll just very briefly talk about what it was like when I came into Overeaters Anonymous. As I said, it was confusing. I came into certain kinds of meetings, and the meetings that I went to, you did hear about people using a food plan. You heard about people weighing and measuring. You heard a lot about people abstaining specifically from sugar and flour. But the meeting rooms that I went to, and I came in 1990, there was no piece of literature on the table that referred to food in specific ways. In 1987, Overeaters Anonymous World Service Business Conference voted to no longer publish any food plan. And so that was what I came into in Overeaters Anonymous. But there were meetings in my area that were called gray sheet meetings that used a food plan that had been popular in Overeaters Anonymous. And the people who went to those meetings, everyone who considered themselves abstinent was using that food plan. And I went to a few of those meetings, and they made me feel a little confused and scared because that wasn't what I was doing, and I started being afraid that I wasn't doing it right. No one in any of those meetings ever said you're not doing it right, but that was how it was practiced in those meetings. In my area, there were also what were called 90-day meetings, and the 90-day format, which I think probably some of you might be familiar with, started in my area, and there was actually an intergroup that was primarily made up of these meetings in which there was a requirement that you have 90 days of abstinence in order to share at the meeting. And pretty much everybody followed the same kind of food plan. They followed the same kind of disciplines in working the tools. These meetings I also felt uncomfortable in. Meanwhile, the people who went to those different kinds of meetings came to my kinds of meetings, and they felt uncomfortable. And in my area, 1990, when I came into Overeaters Anonymous, there was actually a lot of dissension. My intergroup, Metro West intergroup, in the Boston area, in the western suburbs, formed in a very classic way. They say, in AA, they say, all you need to start a new meeting is a resentment and a coffee pot. And Metro West Intergroup broke off from Mass Bay Intergroup basically over resentment about a couple of different issues, but a lot of it had to do with this philosophy towards working the program. And over the years, by the time I came in OA, this had been 8 years, and there had really been some hardening of sentiment. So the OA culture that I came into actually had a lot of animosity and hostility in it, and I heard people in my intergroup referring to them. And I know people in the other intergroups referred to them. And I'm going to use this word once, and I'm not going to use it again. I still hear it sometimes in Overeaters Anonymous, and it saddens my heart. I heard people refer to people in OA who worked the program in a certain way as Nazis. And I find that not to be a term that encourages a spirit of unity. And sometimes it was meant sort of offhand. Some people sort of claimed it as a term of honor, like, I'm one of these. But this is what happened in my area. So, you know, things went along, and there were actually people would say, don't go to those meetings. Sponsors who would forbid their sponsees to go to those meetings. And I'm not saying which, it was on every side. And my intergroup meetings often had this, feeling of separateness. In the other intergroup, there was an unwillingness to participate at the region and the world service level over things like that 90-day format. Well, a few years go by, 1992, I decide to sign up to work on the Region 6 Convention. Four intergroups in my area. Now, this is a scenario that is described in this book, in Tradition 1. I don't think it was specifically us, because this was four intergroups who got together to chair a convention. And that meant we all had to work together. It was a miraculous healing that we actually all got together and saw that, you know, the other people didn't have tails or whatever. And we came together on what we agreed on. And the convention was a tremendous success, and it built bridges. Now, going forward a few years after that, I think it was about 1995, there was, in one of the intergroups, in Mass Bay Intergroup, there was a group of members in meetings who very strongly wanted to be able to require certain things and to endorse a single plan of eating and a single way of eating. And then there were others in the intergroup who felt, you know, in order for us to be an OA meeting and to be in the harmony, in the spirit of harmony with OA as a whole, we can't do that. We have to make it clear that OA does not endorse a particular plan of eating. These meetings broke off and formed a new 12-step fellowship. Now, this was an incredible thing, and nobody could have foreseen this, because, of course, when we all saw this coming, we all saw it as disaster, okay? We all saw it as a threat. And these new meetings that started out, they're going to come and raid our meetings like pirates, and they're going to come and steal our members. This is what happened. Those of us who were in the more earthy, crunchy meetings, or, you know, whatever you want to call it, we really started to examine ourselves. Are we being clear about the importance of physical abstinence, about physical recovery? Are we? Because I'll tell you, there were certain meetings that I went to that you almost felt ashamed to stand up and say that you were abstinent and that you had lost a certain amount of weight or gained a certain amount of weight or had stopped throwing up or whatever it was, because sometimes, you know, you might even hear crosstalk with that somebody felt shamed by that. That was certainly never my intention. I wanted to share this miracle in my life. So I think the intergroup, these meetings as a whole, really started to take our inventory, and we realized how precious threefold recovery was to us and how precious abstinence was. Now, I started going to the World Service Business Conference in 1999, and that was the year the first motion came to the conference floor to again start printing a pamphlet with recommended plans of eating, to start again, because it was felt that in many areas of OA that we weren't giving people enough concrete guidance. What do you do with food? It took 4 years for that pamphlet to get approved, and believe me, there was a lot of blood, sweat, and tears out there on that conference floor, but what we ended up with was the dignity of choice, which I love. So Overeaters Anonymous itself, just as our personal recovery has evolved, our fellowship has evolved. And that's, I think that's kind of an interesting way to look at the first three steps and the first three traditions together, not only for our recovery as individuals, but for moving forward together, that we cannot recover in a vacuum. If I am to live, for me, to live is to recover. I do believe I have a fatal illness and that I have no alternative. Once I recognize what my problem is in this program, once I recognize what it really means to be powerless over food, once I accept that, yes, I do have this cunning, baffling, progressive, and fatal disease, I must accept I am never going to find a treating professional, no situation in my life, no human power, no human situation, no material, physical solution, and nor any mental solution, no decision, no resolution that I make just based on my behavior and my will is going to arrest this disease, the course of this disease. Once I accept those facts, those two realities, then I have to realize that I need a power greater than myself. And I'm not saying that the 12-step solution is the only one out there. If there was another one that worked for me, this is what I found. I'm happy. What? Once I accept that, then I have to accept the solution that's offered here, because this is the only one that's ever been presented to me that acknowledged the scope of my problem. So once I've done that, I have to fit myself to OA as it is, not fit Overeaters Anonymous to me, because I can't. I have to take it as I find it. But the paradox is that when I come in here and I start sharing myself and I start growing, then I am a part of OA's movement forward. And I can take effective action. And here's another one of those paradoxes. I came in here. So I'm just going to confess this right now. I'm a control freak. Is there anybody else who suspects that they might be a control freak? Yeah, and the rest of you, we'll talk later. I am a stone down to the roots control freak. And what I keep seeing, as I'm often able to relinquish control, or at least I am able, well, for example, I'm able to not say the thing that I think you need to hear. The impulse is still there. The belief, oh, this is what you need to hear, but I might be able to bite my tongue that one time. But there's so many different ways that I can control that I wasn't even aware of. I knew about the overt ones. I knew about, this is something I heard, when you suggest something to me once, it's a suggestion. The second time you bring it up, you're trying to control me. And I recognized, when I heard that, like, yep, that held a mirror up to me. Maybe you didn't hear me right the first time. Maybe if I say it a little bit louder. This time I'm going to phrase it as a question. I was able to recognize those overt ways of controlling, but then I'm also passive-aggressive at times. People were here last night heard me talk. I was, the whole month of January, I was doing this intensive workshop in another field of endeavor. It was very, very intensive. And there was one activity that we did that was called play. And there was essentially a game of red light, green light. And as we played that game, the teacher stopped us occasionally and drew our attention, didn't just said, notice what's happening. And he started drawing my attention to all the different ways that I have of managing the game control. He would say, so are you planning ahead? Managing the game. Are you, you know, there they go. Look at that one is really close to tagging the person. Do you hang back and don't try? Managing the game. Do you decide to hide behind somebody else? Which is, you know, another strategy, managing the game. And he just kept calling out all these different behaviors. Every single one of them I have done. If I can't win, I won't play. That's control. If I tell myself I can't, that's control. It's all control. Even when I have told myself that I'm giving up, but what I'm really, that I'm giving up control, but what I'm really doing is giving up. What I'm really doing is withdrawing once again. What I'm really doing is withdrawing myself from life. And that is a way of controlling it. Fear is control. Worry is control. I'm going to make a decision about how you are what you're thinking about me right now, and in that way, I am controlling you. Of course, it doesn't work. Obviously, it's when I say it like that, it's ridiculous, right? But I believe that that's what it's founded in. Then I don't have to be disappointed. Anybody have that magical thinking? If I wish for something too much, then somehow I'm going to jinx it or whatever. Yeah, right. So I start to manage the game. I'm going to start talking myself out of it. I'm going to start telling myself why it isn't really that good anyway. Instead of simply not knowing. In this program, in step one, we are essentially standing on the edge of the precipice. And we're being told, if you are one of us, if you identify with our stories, if you come in here and you recognize yourself in our stories, if you are one of us, you're doomed. There's no, you know, you're at the last house. There's no solution for you. Doing what you've been doing, it's never going to work. Now, we want you to leap. We want you to leap into a way of life that you can no longer control. We want you to leap into a way of life that demands that you trust, surrender, and that you commit to a course of action even when you don't believe it's going to work. How many in this room have ever thought, I cannot abstain? Managing the game. It hurts too much to let in the possibility that this might work, because what if it doesn't? Managing the game. This is why a surrender to a power greater than yourself will not be sufficient, because we cannot do this alone. We can't even do it just with our higher power. We have to do this together. We have to let our voice into the room. We have to tell the truth. To the extent that we know it. Claire and I were talking earlier about that I don't know what I don't know. And I can't make an admission of something that I'm not aware of yet. And believe me, I've got a lot to learn. I keep learning more, you know, because I keep learning about the ways that I keep managing the game. You know, my ego is so good at going, oh, I do that? Well, then I'm just not going to do that anymore. All I'm doing is putting a hat on it, you know, and calling it George. And it's the same thing. But it's okay. It's all right. It's worth doing. So in step one, we make this really should be a very scary admission that we are powerless over food. It's gonna get ya. And that our lives have become unmanageable by us, that we cannot control the game. In tradition one, we also make a collective admission that our personal recovery, our recovery as an individual, depends upon our recovery as a fellowship. Unless we come together, we cannot recover. And so we not only, every one of us, those of us who have been in for a day, a decade, 30, 40 years, all of us, our recovery depends not only on our daily practice of the program, our recovery depends upon our observance of the traditions. The good news, so the bad news is that we're all responsible. The good news is that we're all responsible. So no one has to do it alone. Does anybody here have trouble asking for help? Okay. So before we break into groups, I did a retreat a little while ago, and at the end of it, one of the evaluations said, I was referring to the steps, but I wasn't spelling them out. And, you know, I make assumptions about, you know, how it is. When you come into these events, workshops, and retreats, there's such a wide variety of familiarity with the lingo and, you know, the culture and the, you know, what's in the literature and stuff like that. But so forgive me for those of you to whom this is well-trod territory, but I just want to talk very briefly about the origin of the steps and the traditions, where they came from. I think, you know, everybody knows that Overeaters Anonymous, actually the co-founder Roseanne first was exposed to the 12 steps when she saw a TV show about Gamblers Anonymous. But Gamblers Anonymous was, of course, based on Alcoholics Anonymous. And in 1939, this group of people who had been recovering by getting together and helping each other decided to publish a book because they couldn't get the word out fast enough one-to-one. They wanted to publish a book that would make it possible for anybody who read it to recover by following what was instructed in the book. And they were going to lay out the problem, the solution, and then they were going to have their stories so that people could identify with them and recognize themselves in those stories. Now, the first people who started doing this thing, you've heard of Bill Wilson, and he 12-stepped a guy named Dr. Bob, and when Dr. Bob got sober, that was the beginning of this fellowship. But Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob had both been exposed to the teachings of something called the Oxford Group. It was a Christian spiritual community. And they had the four absolutes, and the 12 steps were derived from the four absolutes. So the 12 steps were, you know, essentially boiled down to clean house, trust God, help others. Or I have it broken down, let's see. There's also a four-category breakdown that I like. Do I have it? Yeah. Give up. Steps 1, 2, and 3, give up. Steps 4, 5, and 6, fess up. Steps 7, 8, 9, clean up. Steps 10, 11, and 12, grow up. Give up, fess up, clean up, grow up. The writers of that book, Alcoholics Anonymous, primarily Bill Wilson, but there were other people who insisted that things be done in a certain way. They were the first ones who wrote down, they expanded those four absolutes into 12 steps of action that they thought could be helpful. They had done them themselves, they were very important, and they published them. Now, in 1960, some housewives in L.A. got together And they started a new fellowship, and they were going to rewrite the 12 steps. Roseanne felt very strongly, and if you read that book, Beyond Our Wildest Dreams, which I strongly recommend, you'll see she felt pretty strongly that the 12 steps were kind of antiquated, outmoded, sexist, you know, all that stuff. And she was going to improve on them. You'll notice that except for changing the words alcohol and alcoholic to food and compulsive eater, our steps are exactly the same. So that happened. And there are two wonderful books in particular if you're interested in finding out how not only we came to have the steps, but how the traditions came to be. And those are the books in AA. AA Comes of Age. Every piece of AA conference-approved literature is approved for sale in Overeaters Anonymous. It is cool to sell them and buy them and stuff like that in your meetings. And the other, of course, is Beyond Our Wildest Dreams, because we didn't just copy it wholesale. We went through all the struggles, and we have challenges in Overeaters Anonymous that other 12-step fellowships don't, as you know. In some of the fellowships, you just abstain from the whatever completely, and then in some of these other fellowships, you really have to live in the world. We have to eat, so we have another set of challenges. So that's where those all came from. The connection, I think, is very important to see. The traditions, they say that the steps prevent suicide, the traditions prevent homicide, and then we have the 12 concepts for service that prevent genocide, so that we don't murder ourselves as a species. Shall we close this session? Can I suggest that we do it with I put my hand in yours? I put my hand in yours, and together we can do what we could never do alone. No longer is there a sense of hopelessness. No longer must we each depend upon our own unsteady willpower. We are all together now, reaching out our hands for power and strength greater than ours. And as we join hands, we find love and understanding beyond our wildest dreams.